You're listening to Parents, You've Got This, the expert guide to parenthood.
The complete guide to pregnancy, birth, baby and parenthood. This podcast is brought to you by Parents, You've Got This and proudly supported by Mestella. Mestella is a natural origin skincare for babies and children, recommended by healthcare professionals. Mestella by Parents' Side since 1950.
An ENT expert plays a crucial role in the healthcare of our children by diagnosing a wide range of conditions related to the ears, nose, throat and neck. Today we are joined by our ENT expert, Dr. Eric Levi, and we're going to be talking all about some common conditions that children face and what we can do about them. Now, Dr. Eric is a specialist pediatric ear, nose and throat doctor. He treats general ENT conditions such as hearing loss, ear infections, allergic rhinitis, sinusitis, snoring and sleep apnea. He also treats conditions and conducts research on other less common conditions. And we are so lucky to have him with us today sharing his amazing expertise. Eric, thank you so much for being here.
That was a mouthful, wasn't it?
A lot of things. I have so many things that you do. It's amazing. It really is.
Good to see you, Christy and Freya. Lovely to be here. Always awesome to have a chat with you.
So, Eric, we thought we'd talk today about some of these common conditions that, you know, you see as an ENT. And we thought we'd start off with the ears.
Of course.
What do you see as an ENT?
Well, the ear is such an irresistible organ, isn't it? I have to throw that in.
Yeah.
Of course, the ear, you know, is quite a fascinating little organ that really, you know, we depend on it all the time. So what do I see? Most commonly, of course, ear infections. If you've got kids, and a study showed that up to about 80 to 90% of kids by the age of 4 would have had at least one ear infection.
Wow.
Now, one of the fascinating things is that a lot of people think ear infection is just one thing, but there are actually several different kinds of ear infection. It actually begins from where or which part of the ear is affected. So if we just do a simple little diagram, you know, I brought this in just because it just helps us to understand. So the ear is ear canal on the outside, then you've got the eardrum there, and then you've got the middle ear that is connected to the back of the nose. So the eardrum is like a special skin, so it separates the outside and the inside. So when we talk about an ear infection, one of the first things I want to know is whether it's an outer ear infection that happens on the outside of the eardrum, so it involves the ear canal, and that has to do with swimming, water exposure, people putting things in their ears like cotton buds and things like that, or wax impaction. Those things can cause the outer ear infection. But then a lot of kids actually have the middle ear infection, which is related to fluid that builds up behind the eardrum that is meant to be draining into the back of the nose through that little eustachian tube there that sometimes gets blocked up by big adenoids or viruses. So one of the first things that I ask when people tell me, oh, my kids get a lot of ear infections, I say, well, what kind of ear infection? Is it due to swimming and water exposure and fluid leaking out? So that tells me that it's mostly an outer ear infection. Or whether it's due to a middle ear infection, when they get a cold, they get blocked nose, then they get fluid behind the drum, then they lose a bit of their hearing, and then the drum bulges full of pus and fluid. And that's something that we can actually assess based on history and also on looking into the ears itself.
What about things like grommets, Eric? Yeah. So I feel like grommets is a word that's bandied about so much. Everybody's heard about them. What sort of conditions would you actually use grommets to treat?
Excellent. So when we talk about grommets, we talk about the treatment for middle ear infection behind the drum. So for treatment of the outer ear infection, when you've got a leaky ear because of water exposure, then the simple treatment will be keeping the ear dry, using some tissue spears, using a hairdryer in a cold setting to dry the outside of the ear, and potentially even ear drops that you might get from your general practitioner, family practitioner, ENT surgeon. So that's an outer ear infection related to swimming and water exposure. Middle ear infection, now, it's true, when you have, we talk about more than 4 ear infections per year, or if each of these middle ear infection is significant, causing fever, missing school a lot, pain, there are some other complications such as meningitis and mastoiditis, some of the scary ones that don't happen very often. So when you get more than 4 middle ear infections a year, or when you have fluid that lasts more than 3 months causing hearing loss, that would be a reason for grommets. So what is a grommet? A grommet is a plastic little tube that we actually insert through the drum. So it's allowing the middle ear to communicate with the outer ear. And that's the reason behind grommets, is to try and reduce the amount of time that the middle ear is full of fluid. So grommets get inserted as a general anesthetic, as a day procedure, and the grommet usually lasts for up to about 6 to 18 months or so, and it eventually just pops out on its own. And sometimes it gets stuck in the ear, sometimes it pops out and it just leaves a hole. There are lots of potential complications, but pretty rare, you know, about 3% or less.
Wow, that's great. And so if people are coming to see you, you know, with grommets, you talk about hearing loss. Would that be the only reason for hearing loss someone would come to see you, or you'd have other reasons for hearing?
That's by far the most common cause of hearing loss in children. So children born with hearing loss is actually pretty rare. So that's a congenital hearing loss. That's pretty rare. But children coming in with middle ear fluid, middle ear effusion or middle ear infection, that's quite common. What are the risk factors? Well, of course, lots of our kids go to childcare and go to school. There's a lot of childcare bugs. Reflux disease, parents who smoke, carers who smoke. There are other risk factors as well that is associated with repeated middle ear infection. But the most common thing is being in childcare, being exposed to lots and lots and lots of other kids, not swimming, interestingly. Swimming is for the outer ear, but middle ear infection, that's usually due to exposure to other viruses. And so in that regard, when they come into to the office, the first thing I want to know is how long has this been going on for? If it is just middle ear fluid with very limited hearing loss, you might just watch and wait. As we come into summer, for example, I might just watch and wait a little bit longer. Because if you think about it, it's a general anesthetic and you still have to puncture the drum. So it is an intervention. So we leave that for someone who is a bit more severe, more than 4 ear infections a year, or moderate or severe hearing loss that lasts more than 3 months affecting their language development.
What about the nose, Eric? So you must see a whole host of different conditions that people come in to see you about. Can you talk to us about a few of those conditions?
I'm a nosy doctor.
Another
one of those. So with regards to the nose, of course, probably the most common thing is people say, oh, doctor, my kids have got sinuses all the time. My kids have got, you know, snotty nose all the time. Now, even the term sinuses or snotty nose could mean lots of different things to different people. So one of the first things that I want to tease out is, how long has this been going on? What's the story? Is it a blocked nose or is it runny nose? And as a big group of nasal congestion or rhinitis, there are multiple causes. There's infant rhinitis, there's even pregnancy rhinitis as well. I mean, a lot of your audience would know a little bit about that. There's pregnancy rhinitis, infant rhinitis, there's vasomotor rhinitis in the older population, there's viral-induced rhinitis, there's also allergic, non-allergic rhinitis. So there's multiple causes to a nasal congestion. Because if you think about it, our nose is always filtering hundreds of liters of air every single day. So what that means is that particles, pollen, grass, dust, mite, viruses, just lands in the nose and the nose reacts to it, so produces swelling and mucus. And with all of that mucus, you just get really, really snotty. And so when I see a child, for example, an infant with rhinitis, well, I just want to assess their severity. Lots of kids get snotty nose, but there are kids who have snotty nose but have a significant effect on their life and breathing. And that's the one that I want to treat. What are the simple things that we can look at? Environment, exposure to pollen, grass, dust, mite, molds in the house and things like that. You know, could we actually deal with that? Simple things such as saline sprays might actually be helpful, and that's pretty safe to use even in younger children. You know, simple aspirators that you can use as well to try and help get rid of the snottiness. So those are the simple things. But if this is a persistent problem and it's been going a long time and it's affecting the quality of life of the child, then we might need to think about other means. And how I look at them is, when I look at the adenoids and the tonsils, sorry, the adenoids and the turbinates inside the nose, that's when you know, we think about what are the treatment. I mean, I've got a simple example here again of this thing. So that's the nose at the front. Everyone talks about the adenoid as being the reason for nasal obstruction, but the adenoid is actually far behind. There are these things here called the nasal turbinates that could potentially get swollen due to allergies, and those are the things that we might be able to treat with a simple nasal sprays as well. Simple things like that.
And so if someone has got, you know, constant problems, do you look at taking out the adenoids?
That could be for some reason. So I always say I have to do the right operation for the right reason, for the right child, in the right technique, at the right time as well. So when I've got a 2-monther with a nasal obstruction that has been pretty new, of course, I'm just going to do simple things like saline sprays. If I've got a 12-monther perhaps that has got pretty significant nasal congestion, I might consider nasal sprays like saline, plus maybe intranasal corticosteroids, which are a little bit of steroid spray. People wonder, is it safe, is it not? We have a lot of discussion about that. It is actually safe in the right situation for a limited period of time. And of course, if, you know, after the age of about 2, you know, they're still persistently having significant nasal obstruction to the point that they're opening their mouth all the time, their sleep is affected, we might need to think about an adenoid procedure or even a turbinate procedure as well, tackling those turbinates at the front of the nose.
What does that look like, Eric, in terms of the adenoid procedure or the, I'm going to say incorrectly, the turbinate?
That's right. It is always a tongue twister, isn't it?
There are tongue twisters.
That's right. The turbinate is actually those bones that filter and humidify the air that you breathe in, but also, therefore, is the first place that pollen, grass, dust, mud, and all the exposure to different humidity actually lands, and that's what it causes the problem. So if that was the case, the first thing I'll do is I'll use a tiny little camera in the clinic just to have a look at the turbinate inside. If the child is old enough to tolerate the camera going all the way back to have a look at the adenoids, that might be something we do as well, depending on the child. Some kids do really well, some kids don't. And you don't want to harm a child, of course, in clinic. Mm-hmm. I just want to still play with them and trust, they develop the trust. Once in a while, we can do an x-ray as well. That might actually give us an idea of the size of the adenoids. So if we do feel that the turbinates are large and the adenoid is large as well, and it impairs their quality of life, then yeah, coming to the hospital, general anesthetic day procedure, we use a camera to look inside the nose to try and shrink the turbinates either with cautery or with reduction and removing the adenoid and or plus minus removing the adenoid at the same time as well. Those two things are day procedures. Yeah.
And do you see children that have constant nose bleeds?
Yeah, that's right. Very common. So constant nose bleeds. If you've blocked your nose and breathe through your mouth gets dry really quickly. So the nose is a very drying area because air moves in and out all the time. So preventatively, for example, some of the things that you can do is try and help the nose to be as wet as possible. So we can use saline sprays, nasal cream like Vaseline, Sorbolene, Nasalate, all sorts of creams that just keep the nose reasonably moisturized. So those are the preventative things that you can do to reduce the risk of drying in the nose and therefore the risk of bleeding. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, if you get repeated nosebleed, we might have to cauterize the nose. And again, depending on the age of the child, most adults can tolerate, nasal cautery in clinic, but you know, some young kids might not tolerate that. Hardly ever do we need to take them to the operating theater, unless of course they've got really, really severe bleeds.
Yeah. What about the throat, Eric? Yes. What are some of the common conditions that you see that are relating to the throat?
That's right. Probably the biggest thing is tonsils. You know,
yes.
tonsils. The tonsils form quite a significant part of my assessment as an ENT surgeon. So the tonsils are those big, what we call cushions around the back of the throat. There's a lot of saying that says, oh, the tonsils filter everything and the tonsils fight infection. Interestingly, they don't actually fight infection.
They're there
as almost like a sampling mechanism. What I mean by that is this. Everything that you breathe has to go through the nose, past the turbinates and the adenoids. Everything that you swallow or breathe through the mouth has to go past the tonsils. So the tonsils are basically like little cushions and they sample little things that goes through. So little bits of particles get in there. What fights infection is your immune system. It's your white blood cell. And there's a whole host of multiple different kinds of cells that forms part of that immune system. So the adenoid around the back of the nose, the tonsils around the back of the throat, the lingual tonsils behind the tongue, the tubal tonsils near the eustachian tube, they form part of a network. On top of that, they are linked to the network of lymph tissue around the neck, the spleen, the liver. It's a complex network. So the tonsils are just the tip of the iceberg. So literally about, 100 grams of tissue that just samples different things. Removing the tonsil doesn't mean that we're removing the way that the body fights infection. So if I just think about the number of kids that get referred to me with recurrent tonsillitis or sleep apnea. Those are probably the two big reasons. I ask my trainees all the time, what are the three major reasons to remove the tonsils? Number one is obstruction. So for example, if you've got big tonsils, that you actually end up getting sleep apnea. And number two is recurrent infection. So we talk about 7 or more infections a year, or maybe about 5 every year in the last 2 years, so 10 over 2 years, or maybe 3 per year over the last 3 years. Or if these infections are severe, missing lots and lots of school, mm-hmm. That that would be a second reason to remove that. So obstruction, infection, of course, malignancy, you know, the scary stuff. Yes. That all don't often happen in children. Once in a while, we pick up lymphoma in children, but that's pretty rare. But in adults, you know, there might be some cancer around the tonsil. But relating to children in particular is the sleep obstruction and the recurrent infection.
And what about swallowing difficulties or drool? I think, you know, babies do drool a lot,
but does it
get to a point where it's too much?
Yes, that's right. So fascinatingly, I'm part of a drooling team in my local pediatric hospital. And so we look after drooling the whole spectrum. So we talk about, you know, difficulty swallowing or some drooling. If you think about it, if you block your nose and open your mouth and see how you swallow, you can't. Mm-hmm. If you have big tonsils, that makes you hard. Makes it difficult to swallow. If you've got big adenoids that blocks your nose, that's when swallowing and drooling happens. Swallowing difficulty and drooling happens. You know, try blocking your nose and swallow. It's very hard. And so those are things that can be treated. Again, not every child with a big tonsil needs their tonsils removed. We assess the severity. Back in the day, 30, 40 years ago, yes, every big tonsil got removed. But now we know that sometimes the size alone don't really affect the child as significantly as we used to think. Mm-hmm. So what we're looking for now is actually the impact on the tonsils and adenoid on the child. If the child is having sleep apnea, if the child was having repeated infection that's pretty bad, then yeah, we would consider removing the adenoid and tonsils. Drooling, if we could wait it out a bit and see how they are of over the age of 2 to 3, we might not do a tonsillectomy for that, of course. We put a lot of things into consideration prior to even offering a surgical intervention.
And what about language difficulties, Eric? Do you see people coming to you with, you know, that their child is having language difficulties?
Yeah.
And then what would you be looking at in that situation? Mm-hmm.
So putting it all together is very nice. Yeah. We started off talking about the irresistible ears. and then we talked about the nose and we talked about the throat. So if your hearing is poor due to middle ear fluid, if your nasal congestion is bad, if your tonsils are large, then of course that will affect how a child speaks. If you think about it, if your ears are always underwater, everything will sound really muffled and unclear. So a child is only repeating that muffled hearing that they get, or they hear, or they receive. And if you've got big tonsils, of course, you sound like hot potato voice. There's something quite big around the back of the throat. And so it does impair. So again, we don't put grommets on every child. We don't take out the tonsils on every child. We assess the severity on all of these things. And so, yeah, if you've got any language delay, one of the first things I do is do a hearing test to check for the and make sure that the hearing is normal. I'll assess their ear, I'll assess their nose, and I'll assess their throat. But also taking into account everything else, the shape of their mouth, the shape of their jaw, the position of their tongue, the way that they actually swallow. There's 8 billion of us on planet Earth, so that means there's 8 billion permutations of how the nose, the mouth, and the tongue and the neck is positioned. There's structural things that I can help with, like big tonsils, deviated septum, big turbinates, big adenoids, and all those things. But there are also other kind of what we call neuromuscular control. And sometimes that's the one where other specialists, such as a speech pathologist, gets involved in, audiologists, even the pediatricians and counselors and sleep, you know, counselors get involved as well in all of these things. Mm-hmm. It's not a black and white, disease. We really look at the whole child.
Yeah. And what about the mouth?
Yep. Well, again, that's the, you're right, so that I get to see a lot of kids who come in with things like mouth breathing. You know, what do we do, Eric, when my child is mouth breathing all the time? Again, I look at the severity. If a child is persistently mouth breathing, I want to look at the whole shape of their head and neck, maxilla, mandible, tongue position. I'll look at their nose and how they breathe. If there's anything that I can reverse simply with sprays and medication, that would be a good thing. Otherwise, we'll be thinking about the position of the tongue, the movement of the tongue, and of course the throat as well. Sometimes if it fits the bill, sleep apnea, that means they not only snore, they actually stop breathing multiple times a night. So that's sleep apnea. So there's a difference between snoring and sleep apnea. A lot of kids will snore, about 10 to 15% of kids will snore. About 5% of kids will have sleep apnea. So that's a group that we want to catch, the kids who actually stop breathing, pauses several seconds, 10 to 15 seconds, multiple times a night. So if they have issues with sleep apnea, if they have issues with open mouth breathing, if they have issues with language articulation challenges, I would be considering, perhaps if their tonsils and adenoid are large, to consider tonsillectomy as one of the treatments, you know. And again, we don't always jump to a surgical intervention.
Mm.
We'll look at the whole child. Is there any allergic things that we can treat? Are there any behavioral things that we can treat and other things like that? Yeah.
Do you see tongue ties and cleft palates and things like that?
Yes, so we do. As part of a team, we manage cleft. We do manage cleft palate, and that would often be quite obvious, you know, in the first few weeks of life. Interestingly, sometimes I have found patients who are slightly older, and something called a submucous cleft might have been missed. For example, again, that's part of the whole assessment, is looking at the child and assessing every part of their upper airway anatomy, the nose and the throat. When it comes to tongue tie, again, whatever I say about tongue tie, some parts of the community will be upset at what I say. I'm just going to be as open as I can here. It is a very controversial topic. There are certain sections that completely believes that, you know, the tongue tie is the root of all evil. There are certain other groups that completely says, look, we're overdoing it. Tongue tie was never the problem. So whatever I say, I think some people will be unhappy, yes, because I will not be able to give. And that's a whole lot of session discussion. But only I just want to touch by saying that it is never black and white. It's not like appendicitis, when you have a burst appendix and the treatment is very easy.
Yes.
Take the appendix out. There are grades of tongue tie issues. Mm. There are grades of tonsil issues. Just like a big tonsil doesn't always have to be removed, sometimes tongue tie needs to be assessed in the whole picture of the patient and the child. The severity. So I've got three kids, and I know that two of them have got tongue tie. Because it doesn't impair their well-being or their growth, I'm not gonna force them to have any procedure. I also have operated on the children of ENT surgeons with tongue ties. You know, again, it's not black and white. It's all great. And so the best thing I could probably recommend to your listeners is to say, if you're worried about that, get some opinion from different people. And it doesn't have to be just a single speech pathologist or myofunctional therapist or dentist or ENT surgeon. You might want to just get various opinions, because at the moment, it's still very controversial. Hopefully, 10 years from now, the research will be much stronger and we would know who we should operate on and who we should leave alone. But as it stands right now, where we are at this point in time, it's still very controversial. So I come from the point of view of, if it is impairing and affecting the child, and the parents do feel that it strongly affects the child's growth and development, and they have done their kind of due diligence in research and getting opinion from different people, then I'm happy to consider that. You know, at the end of the day, all I want to do is assist the child and the parents. Yeah. I'm not going to be a roadblock for people, but I just have to be fair by saying that it is a controversial thing. There are opposite ends of the opinion piece. I'm sitting in the middle, I'm practical, and I'll just assess the child, you know, as they come, each and every single one of them.
And I think you've hit the nail on the head there. You know, being a parent is so tough, as in you don't know what you don't know until you're in it. And often that's when you need that specialist right then and there. Or you might be listening to this podcast and think, hang on, my child's had reoccurring, you know, ear infections, or their speech is, you know, not quite where it should be. Yeah. How do they go about accessing someone with your expertise?
Well, there are lots and lots of great ENT surgeons around. And actually, maybe I should step back and say, firstly, a lot of these issues are well handled by your local general practitioner, family medicine practitioner, family physician. They're really, really good at it. If your child is seeing a pediatrician, they are also pretty good at it. Of course, there's there'll be others who have repeated issues and they might need to see the ENT surgeon. Well, there are lots of ENT surgeons around. Unfortunately, the waiting list. It everywhere is pretty busy. Seeing a pediatrician takes a few months, seeing an allergy specialist takes a few months, same with the ENT surgeons as well. But just remember that if there are truly, truly concerning issues, airway breathing issues that are severe, you can always go to your local emergency department, of course, in the really, really severe end. But for a general health and well-being of the child, tapping into the help of an ENT surgeon locally would be great. There are lots of other better ENT surgeons out there than me.
Oh, don't know about true. That, Eric. We don't know about that.
You bite.
No. So, Eric, as an ENT surgeon and the most amazing one,
sure.
What would you like all parents to know?
Your your kids are special, right? You know, of course, we're looking at the whole child. And it's almost always never just one thing. There's always a whole host of other things involved. For example, just to take a simple example as sleep. I see lots of kids with sleep issues. Very few of them actually have tonsils and I don't know that's the main issue. You know, that's a lot of other behavioral thing. Being a parent in 2023, 2024, or whenever this episode comes out, is very different to being a parent in the, you know, 1990s or something like that. The rate of allergies have increased. Our intrusion of media and screen has affected the quality of sleep. There's lots and lots of studies out there showing that, for example. Family relationships, behavior, anxiety, all of that. So I think, you know, probably the one thing that I would probably want parents to understand is, firstly, it's not an easy job being a parent. And yes. That's the reason why both of you are here sharing really good information. Finding a network of, you know, a group, a peloton, a network of like-minded parents raising the child as, you know, in a village, you know, situation. You need a village to raise a child. Well, you have a virtual village in your community, and that's what you're doing well, supporting each other as parents. And there's always help available. You know, I think we live in a very, very lucky, blessed country where you can get access to this. And there's a lot of good information available out there as well. I think being reasonable parents, I'm sure you'll be able to actually just screen them and be aware which are the good ones, which are probably biased, you know. And so, yeah, I think that's probably what I want to say.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Eric, for your time today. We really appreciate
My pleasure. It's always good to have a chat with you both.
A huge thanks to Mostella for sponsoring this episode. Did you know that children of parents with a history of eczema, allergies or asthma have a high likelihood of having eczema-prone skin as well? Mostella's Stellatopia range is specially formulated for eczema-prone skin. Fragrance-free, it soothes, protects and strengthens the skin barrier. Stellatopia products from Mostella go through 450 tests and measures to ensure safety and efficacy, and a dermatologist and paediatrician tested. Mostella is our family's favourite.
And a huge thanks to Mostella for sponsoring this episode. You've been listening to The Expert Guide to Parenthood, and never forget, parents, you've got this.
The information provided in this podcast is general in nature and is intended to support, not replace, a discussion with your doctor or healthcare professional. Parents, You've Got This take no responsibility for any medical decisions made by individuals based on the information provided in this podcast.
Join a Parents You've Got This masterclass today to be prepared, excited and educated
for pregnancy, birth, baby and parenthood.
Visit www.parentsyouvegotthis.com.au
and sign up for a masterclass today.